June 14th, 1974. Clearwater, Florida. After borrowing her daughter's car and leaving her home, 38-year-old Margaret Dash never returns, and the abandoned vehicle is discovered in St. Petersburg 1 month later. It turns out that Margaret had been involved in an extramarital affair with a man named Cleveland Hill, who had supposedly threatened to kill her. Over the next 15 years, two other Florida women, 43-year-old Retha Hires and 21-year-old Danielle Johnson, also vanished without a trace after conducting an affair with Cleveland and alleging that he had made threats against them. While there is suspicion that Cleveland was responsible for all these disappearances, there is not enough evidence to implicate him, and the three missing women are never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring not one, not two, but three unsolved missing persons cases: the disappearances of Margaret Dash, Retha Hires, and Danielle Johnson. Each of these victims were African-American women who went missing from Pinellas County, Florida, and since they all vanished during a 15-year window, you ordinarily wouldn't assume that the cases were connected. However, what links them all together is a man named Cleveland Hill, who had been in a relationship with all three women before they vanished, even though two of them were already married and had children. While Cleveland had a wife and children of his own and was considered to be a prominent member of the community, he also had a troubling criminal history, and none of these missing persons cases got much media coverage at all until Cleveland wound up making headlines for entirely different reasons. Obviously, it seemed like too much of a coincidence that these three separate women who had been conducting an affair with the same man would just happen to go missing, particularly since each of them claimed that Cleveland had threatened to kill them if they ended their relationship with them. After each of the victims went missing, their abandoned car would be found, and in two of these cases, their loved ones received a letter in which they claimed to have run away voluntarily, though there was skepticism that the missing women actually wrote these letters. The problem is that without any bodies or direct evidence of foul play, the authorities were powerless to file murder charges against Cleveland or anyone else, so Margaret, Retha, and Danielle are all still technically missing. So on this episode, I'm going to explore each of their individual cases and attempt to figure out if they all happen to fall victim to the same man. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of Margaret Dash. Our first story begins in Clearwater, Florida in 1974, and our first victim is 38-year-old Margaret Dash. For the past 20 years, Margaret has been married to her husband, Leon Dash, and they have three daughters named Elaine, Sharon, and LaDuena, and a son named Leon Jr. On June the 14th, Margaret borrowed Sharon's 1970 Oldsmobile Cutlass and left her residence on Wildwood Street in order to pick up some medicine for a sick cousin. However, Margaret never returned home, which prompted Leon to drive around all night searching for her. But when he failed to find her by morning, Leon officially reported his wife missing to the Clearwater Police Department. Investigators initially put their focus on Leon, but since he was nothing but cooperative and passed a polygraph test, he was quickly ruled out as a suspect. But Leon had his own suspicions about a 26-year-old African-American man named Cleveland Hill Jr., who lived in the city of Largo just over 4 miles away. The Dash family knew Cleveland because he was the minister of the church they attended, the Lighthouse Church of Jesus. Months earlier, Cleveland had once approached Leon at the church and confessed that he was conducting a secret affair with Margaret, but he apologized for it and assured Leon that the affair was over. However, sometime later, Leon claimed Margaret told him that when she attempted to end the affair with Cleveland, he had threatened to kill her. Well, it turned out that Cleveland did have a history of violence involving his own wife, Betty Jean Hill. Back in 1968, Cleveland was stationed at McCoy Air Force Base and had an infant son with Betty Jean, but she decided to file for divorce from him, alleging that he was physically and verbally abusive throughout their marriage and would often lock her inside their home. On February the 5th, 4 days after her petition for divorce was filed, Betty Jean was staying with her mother, Josephine Hillman, when Cleveland suddenly showed up at the residence and started terrorizing them with a gun. He proceeded to take both women into the bathroom, where he shot Josephine 4 times and shot Betty Jean in the mouth and the back of the head. Cleveland then fled the state, but remarkably, both women survived and made a full recovery. A few days later, Cleveland surrendered to the authorities in West Virginia and was charged with 2 counts of assault with intent to commit first-degree murder. Cleveland went on trial in April of that year, but testified that his gun had gone off accidentally during the struggle and never intended to harm his wife or mother-in-law. While the jury still found Cleveland guilty, they elected to reduce the charges to counts of aggravated assault without intent to commit murder. As a result, Cleveland only received a sentence of probation on the condition that he paid the 2 victims' medical bills and stayed away from his wife and son for 5 years. While Cleveland violated his probation the following year and received a 10-year prison sentence, but he only wound up serving just over 2 years behind bars before he was paroled in September of 1971. During a prison furlough, Cleveland found religion at the Lighthouse Church of Jesus, and since his leaders believed that Cleveland had repented and deserved a second chance, he wound up becoming a minister there following his release. Believe it or not, even though Betty Jean's petition for divorce was granted while Cleveland was in prison, and one of the bullets he had fired was still lodged in the back of her neck, she wound up remarrying him 2 weeks after he got out, since their church did not support divorce. However, over the next 2 decades, Cleveland would use his position at the church to conduct extramarital affairs with a number of different women, including Margaret Dash. But it does not sound like the Clearwater PD spent much time exploring this angle, as they only searched for Margaret for 2 weeks before they closed the investigation into her disappearance. Margaret's family did not believe she would have taken off voluntarily, as she left $8,000 behind in her bank account, which was never touched. 1 month after she went missing, the Oldsmobile Cutlass Margaret had been driving was found abandoned in a shopping center parking lot in St. Petersburg, over 20 miles southeast of Clearwater. Since there was no evidence of foul play, the discovery of the car did not prompt the police to relaunch their investigation, and even though Leon hired some private investigators to follow around Cleveland for about a month, this never did lead anywhere. Margaret's case pretty much faded from the spotlight, but Cleveland would find himself at the center of another missing persons case 8 years later. So our next story takes place in Largo in 1982, and our second victim is 43-year-old Retha Ingram Hires, who lives at the Breakers Apartments on Campbell Lane with her husband, Howard Hires. The couple have been together for 25 years and have a total of 6 children, though they have only officially been married for 3 months. On the morning of December the 28th, Retha left her apartment in her white 1976 Ford Elite for what should have been a routine trip to the store to buy laundry detergent, but she never returned home. The following day, Howard received a letter supposedly written by Reatha, in which she announced that she was leaving him to be with Cleveland Hill and wanted Howard to retain custody of their children and not bother looking for her. Well, Cleveland was a friend of the Hyers family, and as you might have already guessed, he had been conducting an affair with Reatha. The whole thing started out with Cleveland giving money and jewelry to Reatha and taking her out to nice places, but 3 months earlier, Howard had caught them together. The whole situation proved so traumatic for Reatha that she actually attempted suicide via drug overdose, but wound up surviving. After she assured Howard that her affair with Cleveland was over, they rekindled the relationship, and Howard finally agreed to marry Reatha. Well, after receiving the supposed letter from Reatha, Howard confronted Cleveland, who denied that the affair was still going on. But Cleveland did express his belief that Reatha had run off with a white man, though he said he had no knowledge of her current whereabouts. Regardless, since Reatha left all of her personal belongings behind, her family did not believe she took off voluntarily, so she was reported missing to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office. Well, 3 months later, in March of 1983, Reatha's abandoned Ford Elite was discovered in the parking lot of an apartment complex on Gulf to Bay Boulevard in Clearwater, but Reatha herself could still not be found. Howard sought a divorce from his wife in absentia on the grounds of adultery, and the courts granted it to him in April of that year. Even though the circumstances of Reatha's disappearance were quite suspicious, the investigation went nowhere, and much like with Margaret Dash, her case soon faded from the spotlight. Well, our third story takes place in 1989, and our third victim is 21-year-old Danielle Johnson, who is a student at St. Petersburg Junior College in Clearwater. Danielle is one of six children to parents Mac and Juanita Johnson, and was staying at their residence in Largo on April the 4th. That morning, after her parents went to work, Danielle left their residence in her 1987 Nissan Pulsar and was planning to drive to campus to attend class, but, as far as I can tell, she never arrived there and did not return home. When Danielle failed to resurface by April the 6th, her father reported her missing to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office. Well, that very same day, Danielle's parents received a letter in the mail that had supposedly been written by her, in which she revealed that she had gotten involved with drugs, so she was moving over 100 miles away to Orlando in order to stay with some friends and, quote-unquote, straighten out her life. Handwriting experts would later determine that the letter was likely written by Danielle, but her family still had a hard time believing it, particularly when they learned that Danielle's Pulsar had been found abandoned in Largo. On the same day Danielle went missing, a local towing company received a phone call from a man calling himself Johnny Bailey, who told them he was having car trouble and his vehicle needed to be towed from behind a Hardee's restaurant located at the corner of Belcher Road and East Bay Drive in Largo. Well, when the tow truck arrived, they did find an abandoned Nissan Pulsar, but there was no one at the scene named Johnny Bailey, and it turned out that the only issue with the car was a loose battery connection. Of course, this turned out to be Danielle's Pulsar, and her parents would immediately suspect that the mysterious Johnny Bailey was none other than Cleveland Hill. Even though Cleveland was nearly twice Danielle's age at this point, they had started dating, and Cleveland would often buy her expensive gifts and give her money whenever they went out. In fact, at one point, Cleveland went so far as to purchase a brand new $22,000 car for Danielle, but her parents were not happy about this and made her return the vehicle. Much like Cleveland's previous relationships with Margaret and Reatha, Danielle reached the point where she wanted to end things with Cleveland, but became too frightened of him to do so. According to Danielle's father, Mac, she said Cleveland had once told her he could, quote-unquote, make people disappear, and in the days before she went missing, Cleveland paid a visit to the Johnson residence. When Mac told him to leave his daughter alone, Cleveland replied, quote, "Well, you better enjoy your daughter, because this may be the last time you see her," end quote. On the same morning she vanished, Danielle spoke to her mother Juanita and said she was afraid of Cleveland because he had threatened her. Even though Juanita advised Danielle not to leave the house that day, she still decided to do so, and this would be the last time her family ever heard from her. When questioned by police, Cleveland denied any involvement in Danielle's disappearance, but claimed she had gotten involved in cocaine trafficking and theorized that she moved to Orlando, much like the scenario outlined in the letter that Danielle had supposedly mailed to her parents. Cleveland told investigators that he was traveling to Orlando on business and would try to find Danielle and get her to contact them, but this never took place. Much like the other two cases I mentioned, the investigation into Danielle's disappearance reached a standstill, but 1 year later, Cleveland would find himself in serious legal trouble. By this point, Cleveland owned a general store in Largo called Handy Corner, and he also ran a paving and excavation business called the Pinellas Paving and Black Magic Paving Company. But even though he lived in a lavish house, Cleveland always seemed to find himself in financial trouble. Between 1974 and 1988, Cleveland was arrested at least 6 times for bounced checks and faced numerous civil judgments. In fact, some of these civil judgments were paternity suits, as during one 6-year period, Cleveland was sued by no less than 4 women who claimed he had fathered children with them, and one of these women was only 17 years old at the time she got pregnant. Cleveland lost 2 of these paternity cases in court and was ordered to pay child support, and he would eventually lose his home to foreclosure and declare bankruptcy. In September of 1990, Cleveland found himself at the center of a sting operation called Operation Real Thing, which was organized by undercover FBI agents and Pinellas County sheriff's detectives. A total of 17 people would be arrested in this operation, including Cleveland and his older brother, Henry Hill. And no, this is not the same Henry Hill who was the subject of the movie Goodfellas. The Hill brothers ran a criminal enterprise in which they would exchange drugs and money for bootleg cases of Coca-Cola Classic, and a business partner of theirs who owned a vending machine company would then sell this bootleg Coke from the machines at a profit. Cleveland wound up being busted when he made an arrangement with an undercover detective to trade 350 pieces of crack cocaine and $5,000 in cash for 5,000 bootleg cases of Coca-Cola Classic. Following his arrest, Cleveland told the media that he had planned to cut a deal for himself by cooperating with an FBI investigation into the Church of Scientology, but backed out because it was too dangerous. Of course, the FBI said this claim was completely false, and in July of 1992, Cleveland was found guilty in federal court of conspiracy to distribute cocaine, a firearms violation, and 4 counts of drug possession. He wound up receiving a 19-year prison sentence, which would be served at the United States Federal Penitentiary in Atlanta. In April of 1993, the Tampa Tribune published an article about Cleveland's connection to the unsolved disappearances of Margaret Dash, Retha Hires, and Danielle Johnson. 6 months earlier, Leon Dash had approached the Clearwater police chief and convinced him to reopen his wife's case. The Pinellas County Sheriff's Office eventually received a tip that a missing woman might be buried in a vacant lot in Largo's Baskin neighborhood, but even though a 3-day excavation was performed of the lot, no evidence was found. Jerry Harper, a former detective with the Sheriff's Office who had investigated these cases, would later express his belief that they had dug up the wrong spot, as a body was supposedly rumored to have been buried in another nearby location which had since been paved over. The Tribune would publish a more extensive article about this story in September of that year and attempted to speak with Cleveland in prison. While he admitted to knowing all 3 missing women, he denied being romantically involved with them, but his lawyer prevented the Tribune from performing an in-depth interview with Cleveland, stating, quote, "A fish who doesn't open his mouth doesn't get caught," end quote. It also turned out that in June of 1990, investigators had been contacted by an informant who told him that Joseph Crawford, an inmate at the Zephyr Hills Correctional Institute, had once worked for Cleveland and knew where the victims' bodies were buried. When Crawford was questioned, he did acknowledge that he once saw Cleveland digging a large hole during the early morning hours one day, but would not provide the location. Cleveland believed that talking any further about these cases could jeopardize the safety of his 3 children, stating that Cleveland, quote-unquote, has the power to get anyone, any place, at any time. The Pinellas County Sheriff's Office also uncovered a report from the FBI's investigation into Cleveland's drug activities, in which an informant told an agent they had overheard a phone conversation which took place between December of 1988 and January of 1989, in which Cleveland allegedly told someone to, quote-unquote, get rid of the bitch, just like before. The same informant also said that they later noticed a large pool of blood in the cooler area of Cleveland's general store, Handy Corner, but the sheriff's office was unable to track the informant down to gather more information about their story. In March of 2008, Cleveland was paroled and released from prison, and he would leave Florida and relocate to Appomattox County, Virginia. By January of 2018, Cleveland was in hospice care and suffering from stage 4 prostate cancer, but detectives from Pinellas County still traveled up there to pay him a visit and see if he wanted to confess to anything. At one point, they even put Cleveland on a speakerphone with his son Tony, who asked if he knew what happened to the three missing women. Even though tears welled up in his eyes during their conversation, Cleveland still denied knowing anything. In March of that year, he passed away at the age of 70. This story would return to the spotlight in June of 2022, when, after receiving an anonymous tip, the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office performed an excavation of a lot near the St. Mary Missionary Baptist Church in order to search for the remains of Retha Hires. Cleveland had once owned this property, but after a week-long search, investigators found nothing, and one of Retha's daughters, Dana Hires, publicly announced that her family had made the incredibly difficult decision to stop searching for her. So after all these years, Margaret Dash, Retha Hires, and Donyell Johnson all continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Well, I'll state right up front that this story isn't really much of a mystery per se, because if Cleveland Hill Jr. was a completely innocent man, and three separate women whom he was having extramarital affairs with all happened to go missing for completely unrelated reasons, then that would be one of the most astonishing coincidences of all time. However, these missing women certainly do need the attention, and there's still a number of unanswered questions in this case. If Cleveland Hill was responsible for murdering Margaret Dash, Retha Hires, and Donyell Johnson, then that would technically make him a serial killer, and I am always terrified by offenders who likely got away with killing multiple individuals over the course of several years, yet somehow managed to make it through their entire lives without ever being charged or convicted of murder. While Cleveland did have numerous brushes with the law and served a lengthy prison sentence for drug offenses, the authorities just could not amass enough evidence to conclusively prove that he killed someone. And even when he was on his deathbed and had nothing left to lose, Cleveland still refused to admit any culpability in the disappearances of these three women or offer any sort of closure for their families. One former detective who investigated these cases and desperately wanted to bring Cleveland down was Jerry Harper of the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, who stated, quote, I tell him, Cleve, one day someone is going to dig up one of those women and I'm going to nail you. He would just laugh at me, end quote. Harper also said, quote, to Cleveland, women are possessions. If he couldn't have them, no one could, end quote. Indeed, it sounds like Cleveland mistreated a number of women throughout the course of his life, and some of them were lucky enough not to wind up dead. I previously mentioned that he was hit with a number of paternity suits during the 1980s, as no less than 4 women claimed that he fathered children with them. One of these women was Felicia Bell, who had 2 children with Cleveland in 1983 and 1984, and said that he pretty much locked her up in a house for over a year and tried to isolate her from the outside world by discouraging her from contacting her family. Sadly, I think the reason that Margaret, Retha, and Donyell wound up dead while these other women survived is that they may have pushed too hard at attempting to end the relationship with him. Of course, what makes this whole story all the more frustrating is that Cleveland never even should have had the opportunity to meet these women to begin with, since he attempted to kill his wife, Betty Jean, and his mother-in-law. Considering that Betty Jean was only 15 years old when Cleveland married her, there were already some major red flags with him, but I have no idea why the jury at his trial decided to knock down the charges of assault with intent to commit first-degree murder to aggravated assault, and the judge decided he should only receive a sentence of probation. I mean, he shot his mother-in-law a total of 4 times, and shot his wife in the mouth and the head, and it's a miracle they even survived. So I don't know why everyone felt the whole intent to commit murder aspect of the crime should be ignored. Yes, Cleveland did go to prison for violating his probation, but if he had served his full 10-year sentence, he likely never would have even met Margaret Dash. But no, it sounds like he managed to convince everyone that finding religion had changed him, and then proceeded to use his new position as a minister to take advantage of people. I get the sense that Cleveland could come across as a very charming guy on the surface, because even after he went to prison for drug offenses and became a suspect in the disappearances of 3 women, there were still members of the community in Largo who defended him and refused to believe he was a killer. They felt that Cleveland was a very generous person who would help people out by giving them jobs and money, but this is exactly how he manipulated so many women into conducting affairs with him, even though some of them were married at the time. I definitely feel sorry for Betty Jean Hill, because even after Cleveland shot her and served time in prison, she agreed to remarry him, based solely on the fact that her church did not accept divorce. It sounds like Betty Jean stayed with Cleveland until he was arrested on drug charges in 1990, and kept visiting him while he was in federal prison, but she definitely knew something was wrong, and probably feared that Cleveland would kill her if she tried to leave him for good. At one point, she apparently asked him about the 3 missing women, and he replied, quote, "If you keep messing with me, I will tell you what happened to those women. I can make people disappear," end quote. It was definitely no big secret that Cleveland was having all these affairs, so you might wonder what would have compelled him to murder Margaret, Retha, and Danielle. Well, the obvious answer is that it was all about control. Cleveland actually reminds me of Robert Weeks, another manipulative and controlling man who has the distinction of being the first wanted fugitive to be captured after he was profiled on Unsolved Mysteries. Like Cleveland, Weeks was a suspect in the disappearances of no less than 3 women. His 34-year-old ex-wife, Patricia Weeks, who vanished in April of 1968, only a few weeks after the divorce was finalized, 47-year-old Cynthia Jabour, who had been planning to end a relationship with Weeks before she disappeared in October of 1980, and 42-year-old Carol Ann Riley, who was also planning to end a relationship with him before she went missing in April of 1986. If that wasn't enough, Weeks was also a potential suspect in the disappearance of a 41-year-old business associate named James Shaw, who vanished in May of 1971. Well, after Unsolved Mysteries featured Weeks' story, he was quickly arrested and indicted for the murders of Patricia and Cynthia. The only reason he was not indicted for Carol's murder is because she had gone missing in California while the other 2 disappearances occurred in Nevada. Regardless, Weeks was found guilty of both these murders when he went on trial the following year and received a sentence of life imprisonment before he died behind bars in 1996. This marked the first time in the history of Nevada that a defendant was convicted of murder without the victim's body being found, and the situation was all the more remarkable since there was not even any physical evidence to prove that a homicide had taken place. But in the jury's eyes, it was just too much of a coincidence that multiple women who were involved in relationships with the same man just happened to go missing, and the same logic applies to Cleveland Hill. I almost wish that the authorities had taken a chance and handed down multiple murder indictments against Cleveland, but considering the time period and the lack of direct evidence of foul play, I can understand the reluctance to do so. One of the saddest things about this whole story is that if you look through the newspaper archives, it appears that the individual disappearances of Margaret Dash and Retha Hires got virtually no coverage when they originally happened, and Danielle Johnson's disappearance didn't get much coverage either. It was not until the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office performed the excavation of the vacant lot in April of 1993, when the Tampa Tribune started publishing articles about these 3 missing women and their connection to Cleveland Hill, who had already garnered a bit of media coverage on his own when he went to prison on federal drug charges. Incidentally, this might be the only case I know in which someone has traded crack cocaine for cases of bootleg Coca-Cola, but it seems like selling this bootleg Coke out of vending machines must have turned a bigger profit for them than simply selling the drugs. But what does it say that Cleveland wound up getting a bigger prison sentence for this than for shooting his wife and mother-in-law? Anyway, let's look at each of these disappearances one by one, as there's a recurring pattern in all the cases. Two of the missing women left the residence to run an errand, while one of them was planning to go to class at their junior college, but in each case, they left in a vehicle which was subsequently found abandoned at another location. So if Cleveland was responsible for each of these disappearances, it makes me wonder where the victims crossed paths with him, as I don't believe there were any confirmed sightings of them with Cleveland before they went missing. It's quite a sharp contrast to the Robert Weeks case, where two of his victims told people they were going out on a date with him and planning to end the relationship, so you can understand how things would have escalated into murder. It's possible that Cleveland may have abducted Margaret, Retha, and Danielle from public places, but part of me wonders if each of them secretly went to see Cleveland without telling their respective families. However, it's clear that all three of these women had become terrified of him and feared there would be consequences if they tried to end their relationships, so I'm not sure if they would willingly meet with Cleveland on their own. In Margaret's case, it seems pretty clear-cut that the Clearwater Police Department botched the investigation because it appears that all they did was look into her husband Leon and clear him as a possible suspect, but then close the case after only 2 weeks. It's possible they may have assumed she ran away voluntarily, even though she left behind a considerable amount of money in her bank account, and they did not bother to reopen the investigation when her abandoned car was found. Considering that she conducted an extramarital affair with a man with a history of violence against women who had been released from prison only 3 years earlier, and Margaret was openly fearful of him, it's mind-boggling that this didn't raise more red flags with the police. At least with the disappearances of Retha and Danielle, their families received letters in which the victims supposedly wrote that they took off on their own, but we didn't even have that in this case. Since Cleveland was now a minister, perhaps the police genuinely believed he was reformed and incapable of harming anyone. Or alternatively, since Margaret was a working-class black woman who had cheated on her husband, perhaps investigators just didn't care about making any effort to find her. If Leon had not pushed the Clearwater police chief to reopen the investigation 2 decades later, I'm not sure anyone would have even heard of Margaret's story. As a side note, the Dash family would experience another tragedy when Margaret and Leon's son, Leon Dash Jr., was killed during the early morning hours of July the 30th, 2007. Leon Jr. had been working security for a party at the Atrium Martini Bar in Clearwater, but after a brawl broke out, Leon tried to intervene and someone pushed him, causing him to fall to the ground and fatally hit his head. Leon Jr. was 48 years old and left behind a wife and daughter, and what made the situation even more tragic was that he died only 3 days before his daughter gave birth to his first grandchild. Since there were numerous people involved in the brawl, police were unable to conclusively determine who threw the fatal punch which killed Leon Jr., until an eyewitness finally came forward nearly 9 years later. In May of 2016, a convicted felon named Preston Lloyd Bell, who was already serving a life sentence on a separate attempted felony murder charge, was finally charged with manslaughter. The ironic thing is that when Leon Jr.'s death made the news, some of the articles mentioned the disappearance of his mother, which was more media coverage than Margaret had received back when she went missing in 1974. So before I start discussing the circumstances of Retha Hires' disappearance, I should mention that while I was researching this episode, I discovered that she had her own separate brush with the law over 5 years before she went missing. On the morning of May the 20th, 1977, Retha and her spouse, Howard, got into a heated argument about money outside a friend's house, and when Retha climbed into her car, Howard used a brick to smash one of the windows. This prompted Retha to climb back out of the vehicle, pull out a .38 caliber pistol, and shoot Howard in the abdomen. Howard was taken to the hospital, but the wound was not fatal, and he wound up making a full recovery. While Reatha was charged with carrying a concealed weapon, Howard refused to press any additional charges or testify against her, and remarkably, they managed to rekindle the relationship. The whole situation is pretty ironic, given that Cleveland also continued to maintain a relationship with his own spouse after shooting her. The situation with Reatha and Howard is a bit unusual, as they were together for 25 years and had 6 children, but never actually tied the knot and got married until 3 months before she went missing. And this was largely due to the fact that Howard had found out about Reatha's affair with Cleveland and she attempted suicide. In both Margaret and Reatha's cases, their husbands found out about their respective affairs, and it sounds like the couples just wanted to put the whole thing behind them and move on with their lives, but I'm guessing that Cleveland had a problem with that. What's particularly bizarre is that after Reatha disappeared, Howard received a letter from her in which she announced that she was leaving him for Cleveland. It seems likely that Cleveland wrote the letter, or at least forced Reatha to write it against her will, but when Howard confronted him, Cleveland denied these allegations and expressed his belief that Reatha ran off with a white man. So this makes me wonder why Cleveland didn't just fabricate this cover story about the white man when he wrote the letter to begin with. After all, since they all lived in Largo, it would have been very easy to disprove the idea that Reatha left her husband for Cleveland. Why intentionally cast suspicion on yourself by including your name in the letter? While the idea of Reatha running away on her own accord does not sound believable, I do wonder if Howard might have initially believed it, since he filed for divorce from Reatha in absentia on the grounds of adultery. But when Reatha's disappearance started receiving media coverage in 1993, Howard told the press that he now believed she was dead, since he felt she would have gotten in touch with someone if she was still alive. I actually learned that Howard passed away only 2 months before this episode's release, but his children had still been actively searching for Reatha and doing what they could to keep her case in the spotlight. Now, Danielle Johnson's case is different from the others in that she was not married when she began her relationship with Cleveland, but there were still many red flags since Cleveland was nearly twice her age and was clearly taking advantage of her. Like many of the other women he had affairs with, it sounds like Cleveland managed to capture Danielle's attention by giving her money and buying her expensive gifts, but this caused great concern for her parents. I mentioned earlier that Cleveland attempted to buy Danielle a brand new $22,000 car, but while none of the sources specifically mention which kind of car this was, that's the equivalent of $54,000 in today's money. Given the circumstances, I can understand why Cleveland wound up going bankrupt and lost his house, even though he had a successful business and was involved in a drug trafficking operation on the side. Much like his other alleged victims, Danielle seemed genuinely terrified that Cleveland would harm her if she tried to end the relationship, but some of the circumstances of her disappearance are a bit different. Margaret and Reatha's abandoned cars were discovered several weeks after they went missing, but in Danielle's case, someone using the name Johnny Bailey actually went to the trouble of calling a towing company to pick up her abandoned car on the same day she disappeared. It seems obvious that Johnny Bailey was Cleveland, and it's possible he did this in order to confuse the investigation, as Danielle had not yet been reported missing at the time her car was towed, so it took a while for law enforcement to put two and two together. Cleveland's actions may have also been motivated by the fact that Danielle's father, Mac, had confronted him before he vanished, so he was likely taking preemptive steps to cast suspicion away from himself. Unlike the letter which was sent to Reatha's family, the letter that Danielle's family received did not make any mention of Cleveland. Instead, she wrote that she was moving to Orlando in order to straighten her life out due to some issues with drugs. I'm not sure if handwriting analysis was ever performed on the letter from Reatha, but it is curious how Danielle's letter was believed to have been in her own handwriting. I mean, we now know that handwriting analysis is not an exact science, so it's possible that the experts who looked at Danielle's letter were mistaken, but I guess it's also possible that Cleveland forced her to write it against her will before he killed her. When Cleveland was questioned by investigators, he expressed his belief that Danielle had gotten involved in cocaine trafficking, and well, in retrospect, that comes off as major projection, given that he himself was busted for drug trafficking just 1 year later. So there's always been speculation that other people out there might have knowledge about what Cleveland did with the victim's remains. We have one informant who claimed that they overheard a phone conversation in which Cleveland instructed someone to, quote-unquote, get rid of that bitch just like before, which implies that he had enlisted someone to either kill one of his victims or dispose of their body. Now, the issue is that this informant believed that the call took place between December of 1988 and January of 1989, and Danielle did not actually go missing until April of 1989, though I hate to think that Cleveland was making plans to get rid of another woman we don't even know about. The same informant reported having seen a pool of blood in the cooler area of Cleveland's general store, Handy Corner, so I wonder if this is where Cleveland killed one or more of his victims, or at least kept their bodies stored. One person who allegedly had knowledge of Cleveland's crimes was a convicted inmate named James Crawford, and while it was reported that he had once worked for Cleveland, it's not clear to me if that meant he was an employee of Cleveland's paving and excavation business, or if he was involved in his drug trafficking operation. Crawford said that he recalled seeing Cleveland digging a hole somewhere, but would not reveal the exact location for fear of his own children's lives. Well, given that Cleveland has since passed away, I would hope that Crawford revealed the location at some point these past 3 decades. But since police have performed a couple of excavations on some vacant lots, perhaps Crawford did reveal the location and they just never found anything. However, during the first excavation in 1993, it was rumored that police were digging in the wrong place and that Cleveland may have buried a body in another nearby location which had been paved over. Indeed, since Cleveland ran an asphalt paving company, this would have been an ideal method to conceal his crimes. In past episodes, I've tried to debunk the idea of murderers disposing of their victims' bodies by encasing them in concrete at large-scale construction projects, such as the infamous rumor about the 3 missing women being buried under a hospital parking garage in the Springfield 3 case. However, the idea of Cleveland digging a shallow grave, burying his victims, and then filling in the hole again before paving over the location with asphalt is not that unbelievable. It would definitely require a lot of time and resources for law enforcement to excavate a spot which has been paved over with asphalt, so I'm sure they would want to be fairly certain there was something buried there before they went through with it. And of course, another complicating factor is that I doubt all 3 of these missing women were buried at the same spot, so a lot of effort would be needed to find them all. Cleveland Hill was the working definition of a narcissistic sociopath, and it sounds like he instilled such a culture of fear in his community that people were afraid to cross him. So even if they had information about his crimes, they were likely reluctant to come forward. But Cleveland has been deceased for nearly 6 years now, so if there are people out there who know something, there's no reason for them to continue remaining silent. However, since an excavation of a vacant lot was performed just over 1.5 years ago during the summer of 2002, this does mean that law enforcement are still receiving tips, so maybe they will eventually get one which pays off. I mentioned earlier that when this excavation turned up nothing, Retha's daughter, Dana Hires, announced that her family was going to give up their search for her, but Dana did say that after many years of passing by this lot and wondering if her mother was buried there, she at least had the peace of knowing that she was not. After all these years, the surviving relatives of the 3 missing women are still seeking answers, and while the man who likely murdered them will never face justice for it, it would be nice if the victims' families could at least recover the remains and give them a proper burial. The disappearance of Margaret Dash is under the jurisdiction of the Clearwater Police Department, so if you have any information about her case, please contact them at 727-562-4080. That's 727-562-4080. The Retha Hires and Danielle Johnson cases are under the jurisdiction of the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, so if you have any information about their disappearances, please contact them at 727-582-6200. That's 727-582-6200. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode about the 1981 murder of Rhonda Hinson, which is technically our podcast's very first edition of The Trail Revisited. I covered that story all the way back on episode number 4 nearly 8 years ago, but since I have learned a ton of new information in recent years, I decided to take a fresh look at the case and put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 2006 disappearance of Maureen Fields. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are my Sharon Ann 80, Josh S., Melissa F., and Alexander J. Thank you so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter or Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.